Hello, and welcome to AMO Kenzoku, episode 61. We are a group of four Bubblegum Crisis Boomer otaku who wanted an excuse to talk about anything, anime, manga, and any related subjects we find interesting. The Kenzoku are...
Hello, I'm Nick.
I'm Sam.
Hey, y'all, I'm Mike.
And I am Dylan. This episode is being recorded on November 21st, 2024. And today we will be discussing the 2006 film Paprika. With that, Hashin! So, Paprika was originally, the first release was at the Venice Film Festival, Venice International Film Festival, in September of 2006. Japanese release was on November 25th of 2006, and the U.S. theatrical release was May 24th of 2007. Running time of the movie is, it feels crazy that it's only an hour and a half to me, at least, and that it, I'm like, how is this movie only an hour and a half? But, and the rough summary is... There is a, a research group that has made some machines that can delve into people's dreams so that others can see it and potentially interact in there. And they've made some they had some larger ones, and now they have some smaller ones that are more portable, and they get stolen. And the team tries to figure out who stole them as they all get sucked into various dreams of the people that, that stole the dream machines. You know, we'll probably have spoilers and such because it's just for one movie. So
definitely spoilers. Can't
talk about it. I agree.
Definitely from there. So from there, there's romps through various dreams and realities and questioning whether you're in a dream or reality, and end up finding out that it's the evil chairman who was the evil one who stole it because he wanted his own reality knot, and ends up getting sucked into a girl body at the end of film, and then we play music. That's my summary. Please add.
I guess since we've gone all the way to the end, like, I do want to did anybody else feel weird about that ending? Like, I'd forgotten how kind of WTF the ending is, and like
abrupt.
Yeah, it's very abrupt. Like, oh, okay, that's it, huh? All right.
Yeah, and we'll be just like in the not quite in time, but in between realities and stuff, and jump back around. But going off of that, I listened to the commentary there, and in it said it was a commentary by Satoshi Kon, the director, creator, which we'll get into more there, and one of the producers, and Hirasawa Susumu, who did the music. Oh. Yeah, it was pretty cool. And really, he did kind of say in there that as they were working towards it, he didn't quite know the ending as they were working towards it. Mm. So it was definitely something where he kind of knew most of everything. But as they proceeded further through production stuff, he still wasn't quite sure how he wanted it to end.
And if I remember right from the making of, like, I think he spent like, it was either like a year and a half or 3 years on the storyboards trying to figure it out.
Is that right? It was a lot of time. Yeah. And it's one of those things that I didn't realize until watching some of this stuff is that, oh my god, like, his storyboards.
Holy cow.
It is, let's take a thing here. So, how do you watch Paprika? It's actually very easily watchable, but how should you watch it is you should spend the $30 or whatever and buy the 4K disc. I can confirm.
I did not own any other version of the movie. I've only seen it once when we showed it, more or less when it debuted nearly 20 years ago. And, you know, I have a pretty strong, fond memory of all of Khan's movies, I would say. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, I think they all, you know, he didn't get a chance to make too many, but I feel like each brings something very interesting to the table. Paprika is no exception, especially from the animation standpoint, because yeah. Holy moly, is this... I'm astonished they were able to only make this for $3 million. Like, straight up, that's a miracle, because something of this quality today probably would cost, you know, $100 million. Like, I could totally be off the mark, but the current, I would say, gold standard in a lot of people's opinions for, like, animation in this era is, like, Arcane. I don't know if anybody's watched that or not. But I believe a single episode of that costs like $7 million to make. So,
jeez.
It, you know, 23 minutes costs that much. And, you know, the show is, it's a different style altogether. So I'm not going to say it's apples to apples. But, like, anybody who watches this movie cannot deny the quality of animation. Even if the topic or the plot is not to your liking, it is a visual feast of a movie. Literally, and I couldn't agree more with Dylan. I ended up just springing for the 4K. I was saying earlier in a private conversation, I really should buy more 4K Blu-rays, because if this is what the end result is, then I've been missing out, because I totally forgot that the PS5 is 4K Blu-ray capable. So I already have the hardware for it without realizing it. And yeah, I'm super happy I ponied up the extra whatever $15 to get the 4K release, because my God, I forgot how good this movie looked.
Yeah, it is really gorgeous. And like it's still kind of in that age when the CG it's more mature. It's like, it's restrained, I think. And I thought they did a good job of incorporating what they did in there. So it doesn't look jarring.
Oh, completely agree. Yeah.
A few points when it's really obvious, but it's surreal enough that in that use that it doesn't take you away from it by the CG being obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly related to CG, but not really. I found it really interesting that obviously Susumu doing the soundtrack was like another chef's kiss, because you know, brilliant score, but this was actually the first time I believe Susumu, and I think even in any major animated production, that for the score they actually used a Vocaloid sampling for it.
Really?
Yeah, they used Lola's voice bank for, so like the female voice in the main theme is actually Lola for the Vocaloid voice bank.
Oh
yeah, I thought that was pretty amazing, because Hirasawa is famous for using all sorts of, you know, MIDI stuff from, I believe he uses Amigas primarily. But this was the first time I think he dabbled with Vocaloid. So it's pretty rad that he, like... Because at the time, Vocaloid was still, I would say, pretty emerging. I mean, it was already pretty... Let's be real, it was already pretty popular by the early 2000s. But it's the first time I feel like it was applied to a major, like, animated, you know, production.
Interesting that Wikipedia claims that this was his last album on the Amiga. But yeah, he did the vocals with Vocaloid. I had no idea.
Mixing Amigas and Vocaloids is definitely, that's some hardware overlap there.
Yeah, you're it's almost four generations of hardware overlap. So,
jeez.
More than that, four decades, I should say, of hardware overlap. But yeah, anybody who's waffling on this, just pony up for the 4K Blu-ray. You won't be disappointed.
Yeah, it's really nice, and they did a nice job on the Dolby Atmos soundtrack upgrades in there too, and everything. And it sounds like in watching their making of it that they actually went through for doing the 4K and redid some of the CG in it.
Oh, I didn't really. I didn't watch any of the kind of remastering stuff.
Yeah, so like the confetti stuff that falls down, because that's all CG, layered CG confetti. As I understood the way you're talking about, it's like they actually like redid it, because when they were trying to kind of like resample and upscale, like it didn't look good in 4K because it wasn't high enough res and it was there. And they're like, well, this isn't that hard. It was one of those things where like, okay, we can put in the effort and do it, but it's not also like that hard to do that sort of thing. It's like, okay.
That's pretty awesome that they went through even that kind of a fine tooth comb, because I don't know. I part of me would like to think that a lot of extra effort was put into this, you know, posthumously for Khan's sake, because for those unaware, he passed away, I believe, from like pancreatic cancer in 2010. It was very aggressive, very sudden. So
yep.
That was a big blow to the industry, I feel, still, because, you know, I don't want to like drill. I mean, maybe I'll hijack. As I was watching this, it kind of really made me, you know, sad to think that, you know, Khan really won't be able to make, like, he didn't release much, but when he did, it was always something. The movies were always, to me, felt very meaningful and impactful for anime as a medium. And it's not to say that there are not people that do that now, don't get me wrong. Like, I would say the two most probably, like, outside of Ghibli, the two biggest names right now are Hosoda and, why am I blanking? Shinkai. Yeah, they're like the two names, right? And don't get me wrong, their movies are great, but they are not Satoshi Kon either. Like, feel like if he was still here, I feel he'd bring such a really interesting element into anime movies. But, you know,
well, even like if you look at Hosoda and Shinkai, like they've each got their different styles, and they're kind of, I wouldn't say they're similar, but they cover, they're kind of close. There's overlap, but like
for sure.
Khan's movies are completely different. Like,
yeah, his are more esoteric in, like, in my opinion, amazing ways. Like, I feel like Shinkai and Hosoda do coming of age stuff really well, and feel good movies really well. Obviously, Khan's capable of doing that. Like, Tokyo Godfathers is, in my opinion, probably the greatest Christmas movie ever made. I'm just gonna say that. Like, even if I feel it's his weakest feature-length film, it still has a very fond... I have very fond memories of it. So,
Which one?
Tokyo Godfathers.
Oh, Tokyo. You think it's his weakest one?
Yeah.
I would say this one is his weakest in my
really?
Opinion.
Really?
Yeah, I've always felt this was and liked Godfathers more.
I wouldn't say this is his best outing. I think, honestly, I feel like Perfect Blue is my favorite, because I like suspense thrillers, so it's a personal thing.
Oh, man, interesting.
I know you dislike Perfect Blue.
Well, it's not that I dislike it. I guess brief story. I saw that movie when I was in high school with a friend of mine, because we were like, look, they're showing anime at the movie theater. Let's go. And so we went to see it, and we were in the car going home, and we're like, let's not tell our parents we saw this. I want to revisit it, though.
Anime and movie theaters, I'm trying to remember. I feel like Paprika actually got a fairly wide release. I might have even made it to our college town.
I remember I saw it in the theater, like, that was up in Seattle. So it got a reasonable release, which at the same time, like, especially back then, it was like, I think that there's a few more things that now, because distribution is obviously very different for movies and stuff now, where it's all whatever, digital drives and stuff, and you can have much of those smaller or shorter run stuff.
Yeah,
but
UPSing prints around is really expensive.
Right. The fact is that, like, it got a release. And I think at that point it was pretty much just Ghibli stuff and Ghost in the Shell. Like, that was basically it. He was the only person, I think, at that point. There's probably was something else, but for one that got a non super only art houses like release type thing, it was pretty cool. It's one of those things where you're like, it didn't do great in the U.S. It didn't do great in U.S. theaters. I don't know what they were expecting it to do. I certainly don't know that, but it's like something in the U.S. It made short of $1 million in U.S. theaters.
They couldn't have been expecting much, right? Because back then,
I know that's the thing. Yeah, it's like, okay, what were you expecting?
The Bebop movie is another one that got a release, which isn't a huge surprise.
Yeah, I feel like hindsight, the probably the reason why like Paprika probably got much of a distribution at all is possibly off the back of Paranoia Agent, because I feel like Paranoia Agent did well enough in the States because it aired on Adult Swim, I believe.
Oh yeah, you're right. I think you're right.
Yeah, or maybe not Adult Swim, but I know it aired on some U.S. Network. So
I would say probably more on the backs of it being Sony distribution, and that it got the original release was a selection at Venice Film Festival, and then it got picked up and lots of other people saw it at film festivals and were like, what the heck is this? Like, this is really cool. So I think they picked it up and distributed it that way for some of the prestige and probably some market, almost kind of market testing stuff for something. It's like, all right, here's an anime movie that's definitely not a Ghibli movie. Let's see what happens. Okay.
Yeah, Sony seemed to try that more often than some of the others. Like, the Bebop movie was Sony, I believe, now that I think about it.
But, yeah. I mean, Bebop was titanically successful in the U.S. as a TV, like, TV right. series, so I don't think that's apples to apples, necessarily.
No, it's not like... Like, you could say Paranoia Agent to in a room full of anime people, and most of them be like, huh, what?
Yeah.
Whereas if you could walk down the street and say Cowboy Bebop, and people would be like, see you, Space Cowboy.
Yeah, yeah. They'd be like, oh yeah, that's that classic anime, and I shrivel up and die inside.
Yeah.
And then there's the what of, like, movies that I remember actually getting a theatrical release, though not a big one, which was Metropolis by Rintaro.
Oh, yeah, that did get a theatrical release.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's one of the things where there were a few others. This was definitely one of those ones that was a few others. I think things are, we're obviously taking complete tangent off here, but I think things are a little bit, I don't know, better these days for that sort of stuff, where they have a better gauge of which ones are gonna get slightly wider, versus which ones are getting like, hey, this movie's here for like a weekend or a week or something.
Yeah, and I'd imagine their cost for the Fathom events is fairly low for the one day only stuff, so they can do
Yeah, it's gotta be.
If it turns out to be a huge hit, then they can do a normal engagement.
Yeah,
I feel like that's probably what they did for like Your Name.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, I don't know on that one. Anyways, let's go back to Paprika. So I think this is kind of interesting, because we've got people are like, meh, this is a weak movie, versus I quite like this movie. The thing that back to kind of the production stuff on it is that, and I didn't realize this, that it's based off of a novel that was written and released in the Japanese Marie Claire magazine back in 1992. Written by Yasutaka Tsutsui. There's a
and
name
he's
for you.
Still alive at 90.
Gosh dang.
Yeah, that's crazy. And it definitely, it seems like there was some, it was a popular novel that got a lot of, I think, interest for doing theatrical versions, but the author was opposed her for the most part until he actually had a kind of a serendipitous meeting with Cohn at, I think it was some screening of something. And he was familiar with, at that point, I think, Perfect Blue, and was like, hey, I would actually like you to do an adaptation of this. Which is kind of cool that he was like, you're a person I could see would like understands what I'm trying to do with this and would do something cool with it. Go.
I think Khan also was saying that before then it was something he had considered before, but it was like either like he didn't feel like he could, like they would let him do it or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it was one of those things where he was kind of thought about it. And he's like, I don't think I can get either the approval for this, and then he might also have had some of those, you know, thoughts of several years. I think it was like 5 or 6 years earlier. I think it might have been back in like the later 90s he was interested in it. Because obviously, Cohn's stuff is very often this mixture of dreams and reality and things that aren't real but are real. So it's definitely something he's been hugely influenced by, this, you know, this novel, and it goes throughout all of his works. So you're like, oh, that's definitely makes sense that he would want to do it. And now the complete aside from there, which is that the bartenders are voiced. The bartenders are voiced by Colin and Tsutsui.
Did a great job.
Yeah.
I was watching one of the things with.
They're the unsung heroes. They are the ones. Yeah.
With the other voice actors, with.
Talk about voice actors. I mean, this was loaded cast. Obviously, you have Hayashibara, you know, headlining, which is, she's always a big name. And then they got freaking Furuya Toru for Tokita. I mean, for those who are unaware, he's Amuro Ray, which is,
And that specific thing is actually, like, they had in one of the interviews with Kon and Furuya and Hayashibara, they're kind of saying that Furuya for Tsukita, like, he was having trouble with the role at first, because he was like, I kind of read the book, and he's like, I realize this is, like, a big guy. And he's like, I don't really know how to do that. Like, am I supposed to be serious or not? And he was having trouble with it, and then he kind of came around to this, like, what do you call it? Kind of like this, like, sense of innocence with it. And Colin's like, yep, you got what I wanted. He's like, really what I wanted to say to you was I want Amuro, but I'm not going to say that. Amuro
without the angst, right?
Yeah, he was literally like, I wanted to say to you that I want Amuro. I just, I didn't want to actually tell you that that's what I wanted you to do. So you figured that out on your own, which was awesome.
That was like, what a great character that was too. Like the whole kind of relationship angle between Tomita was his name,
Tokita and Chiba.
Tokita, yeah, and Chiba. That was just so great, because it's like it was unexpected, and at the same time, like at the end of the movie, it was like, oh, this feels good.
It makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? Like I really enjoyed that. Like, it's, as much as I feel like the ending is kind of abrupt, like the whole everything else about the movie, like, it's composed really well. Like, I think my main beef with the story is it's kind of plain, like the plot. Like, it's like, hey, we have a device. The device is stolen. It's abused because somebody wants to, you know, whatever, get some power. And they fix it somehow, which, you know, okay. But just the way it's all put together with the characters and the interaction, like, I think that's what makes it, what elevates it, like, just above just a weird movie, right?
I agree. Yeah, it's not just an artsy, esoteric movie. It's got a heart and soul to it. Despite fumbling, I would agree the ending is pretty badly fumbled. And I think that's why, that's one of the things that holds it back from being, like, probably my, you know, favorite movie of his. But it has a lot of, really just characters that I love so much. Like, the two bartenders are just so great.
They're so great.
They're like they're just that, you know, sympathetic ear for the detective. Also voiced by Aki Otsuka, so another heavy hitter. Konakawa.
Oh, yeah.
You know, his whole side story, which was tied into being, you know, related to movie making, was kind of like slightly meta, and I thought that was pretty interesting. Although ultimately, I didn't really see how it connected with the overall plot. I don't necessarily think it did. It just kind of was like a parallel plot that collided, because at some point all the dreams collided, and then, you know, they had to be hashed out.
Yeah, and he didn't really solve the murder either, right? Like.
Right, that was just kind of left as a giant gaping, like, he'll get to it when he gets to it. What's important is that he remembers the whole reason why he became a cop in the first place.
What did you guys think was happening when he's on the computer at the website, and then he kind of ends up in a dream? Do you think that was like the dreams already merging in the world, or was there something else going on there? Does he fall asleep at his desk, or?
Yeah, I was trying to think about that as well, because that's like one of those segment transitions that every time I watched it, I'm like, wait, what's happening here? Am I just imagining that I'm going into like this web page, but I'm actually just like sitting there on the web page and all I see is the lady in red? Like,
well, what's funny is that if you look at it through today lens, you can just say, oh, he's in the metaverse. It's totally okay.
You're like, yeah, he put on his Apple Vision and he's surfing the tubes.
Because that's something about this movie I think that's really interesting is the time period it came out in, right? Because it released in 06. Is that right?
Yeah, end of 06.
End of 06. And is 06 still predates any smartphone commercially available, right? Or
It's pre-iPhone.
Smartphones, but not what we'd recognize as smartphones.
Right, not the slab.
Yeah, black,
not the slab.
Blackberries, but right. iPhone was 2007.
Right. So it kind of became an interesting point where, for mass consumer technology, like that one sequence in the dream merge where like you have the schoolgirls with like the cell phone heads, like the flip phone, heads, like
I was noticing that too. It's like, oh man, Galaxy, like those are just really dating it.
Dated, yeah. So as you can just see the time period this was released in. So.
But it is just before, like you say, right? Like they're on the cusp of. They're so deep in the Galapagos syndrome, but like you mentioned, the rest, there are other kind of smart-ish phones like BlackBerry and stuff, but like they don't exist at all in Japan.
Right.
Because it was just the Keitai
flip phones forever.
Yeah. Crazy kinds, but like just, flip phones.
Yeah, like I remember like Sony Ericsson's out of Japan, like for that era.
The U.S., if you wanted a smartphone, like, hard as it is to believe, Windows Mobile, I think, was one of the more common options.
Voice
acting stuff there. And it's one of those things where I should have recognized that it was Toshio Furuya as Tokita, but I totally didn't.
I didn't either.
It just sounded like Tokita to me. And then afterwards, I'm like, looking at the credits interview, I'm like, oh yeah, okay. But he's just like, I could still watch it, and he's just as high as Shibara. Like, he's a great voice actor in that, even if his voice sounds kind of similar to his voice in another thing, like, you still feel like he's the character that he's portraying on the screen and isn't just that same person with a different, who put on a baseball hat instead of a a space helmet. Continuing on with a different area of sound is kind of back to the music of Susumu. And in the commentary, which is pretty great with them, Khan literally says, he's like, I wasn't going to make this movie if you weren't doing the sound. He's just like, I couldn't even imagine making this movie without you doing the music for it. And it's one of those things where you're like, they've worked together quite a few times, back to Millennium Actress and then on Paranoia Agent stuff. But I haven't watched actually Paranoia Agent in quite a while. And, I love Millennium Actress.
Fantastic film.
But I also haven't seen Perfect Blue in quite a while. And that one leaves an impression on you too. But I feel like this one, at least for me, is just like, it's such a ultimate culmination of Susumu's music plus movie. Like, it's so fits it. It was done almost in the other way, but it almost feels like Daft Punk Discovery, where you're just like, oh yeah, well, of course, this is the music video thing that you make to go along this music. It was meant to happen this way.
Yeah.
In this case of Paprika, it actually literally was, where Susumu like composed every piece and stuff and in there. And there's several segments they talk about where the part with Paprika, where she's flying and then goes down into the water to become a mermaid and stuff. Like, it's one of those things where like, I don't know if it's exactly the right term, but I'll say it like it synchronizes, I think synchronizes up very well, but it was almost like, in talking to Susan, he's like, yeah, I didn't quite have the right thing, but I knew there's a musical flow to what you're doing, so I wrote it this way, and it like lines up like just right.
There had to have been like a coincidence, right? Like, or at least they shifted the music around to kind of line up, because they're doing this stuff both totally separately, right?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's like there's definitely feedback and stuff there where they go and they work and then they look and tweak and readapt things there. But it was largely one of those things where they said, he's like, yeah, he kind of came back with this piece and we put it on. It was just like, oh, this was like exactly the right timing for everything.
Mm-hmm. There was one song in there that I didn't really care for. It was like the least Susumu song in it, I think. It's near the climax when she's like, I don't remember. I think there's something at a big tree is what I remember. And it's, I don't know. It sounds more like a traditional movie song. I mean, it kind of turns more into like, it's still, you can tell it's a Susumu song, but it was just kind of like, this feels like kind of like a cop out and just trying to make a climax song. I don't know.
Yeah, be like Susumu would have titled it Climax Song. On a very thing that super frustrates me and I'll soapbox on is the soundtrack right now isn't available in the US, at least as far as I could tell. Maybe I'm wrong and there is some, but at least it has been available on iTunes, which is where I get my stuff from, or Apple Music, and that's where, you know, only whatever 200 million people in the US do, but it's like it still shows it there, but the music, the songs are not available and I can't purchase it from iTunes. I have the CD, but you know, at this point with the way I have my stuff set up, that's annoying.
Yeah,
like I shouldn't have to deal with that. That's not the promise of the streaming. The promise of the streaming services is everything is available endlessly forever, but this is not, and that makes me very upset.
Yeah, I don't know why. Yeah, like, it's a Sony thing too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they own everything.
It just, yeah. I did. I also spent a bunch of time looking for it, like trying different variations, different spellings, like Japanese, English, like, gotta be in here somewhere.
The album has such cool art too.
It's not the movie cover?
It's just the movie cover.
This is different. At least what you posted is different from the movie cover I have.
For the music?
Yeah, for the soundtrack.
Now I have to look.
I'll post later. Okay.
But it's just like the movie thing. Anyways, so that made me upset, and then I was at Final Fantasy concert orchestral touring concert and I got FOMO, so I spent too much money on physical media.
That's right, they can't take that away from you.
That's right,
from my cold dead materia infused hands.
I did one of the things I liked watching the making of thing was there's a part where he says basically like, I know the book will always be better than the movie. So like, there's no point in me trying to like copy the book. And so like, he deliberately set out to make something that's basically completely different than the book. I thought that was, a nice, I don't know what the word is, what else to say. It's a insight, right? It's like, I don't know if that's like part accepting an understanding of the audience or just understanding of himself. Maybe a little of both. But I thought that was pretty wise of him to say that. And it's frankly what I want out of these creators, right? Like,
for sure. I agree. Yeah. I think I've watched a few making of things with Kon, and he seems very self aware and introspective about stuff like that. Like I would feel like he was definitely considered a big name back in the mid aughts, especially after Paranoia Agent.
Mm-hmm.
And I never got an impression that he had, an ego or a massive ego or to speak of.
an outsized ego.
Right. I mean, well, any bigger than...
He does say in there, like, the... He talks about Chinpira-kon and Satoshi-kon. Like, his two selves.
Right.
The punk who, like, kind of recognizes that, understands his talents, but, like, his normal side keeps him in check. But sometimes he's like, oh, yeah, that guy's got a good idea. Like, Chinpira-kon, yeah, go do it. Do it.
Yeah, I thought that was a funny... Chinpira is the Japanese term for, like, kind of, yeah, like a punk kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he says, you have this battle between Chinpira-kon and Satoshi-kon, and most of the time Satoshi-kon wins, but for this movie, I kind of intentionally let Chinpira-kon win.
Yeah. And it shows. It's fun. There isn't really no other way to make a movie about dreams. Like, anime really is the perfect medium for that.
I was about to say, this is the reason why anime exists, is to do something that you cannot... these days, you can probably CGI up something, but it still wouldn't be as visually...
It's going to look terrible.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think visually speaking, and also the thing that, going back to the voice acting, was when people were kind of in that dream state and they just started stammering like gibberish, like... The writing for that, to me, was so interesting.
Really?
Yeah, like, the line delivery, because, like, I think this was... I think it kind of struck a chord with me, because the way people spoke in, like, when they were in that dream state, really, to me, is kind of like what people speaking in dream... Like, speaking when I have dreams sounds like. So, I felt like Kon really kind of... encapsulated that well, and had and found a great way to direct the voice actors to like execute it.
I think particularly the one of note is the first time you get it and you're like, what the heck? When
the director,
when he's talking normally, then all of a sudden you're just like, wait, what is happening?
He's
here?
Talking about the marching frogs, and you're like, what, mate?
Yeah,
like, you're like, what?
And Kon would definitely appreciate that, because he actually on the commentary he was talking about that scene. He was like, this sounds kind of like nonsense words, but it's really not. I spent a lot of time like trying. This was a lot of work to get this to be like written correctly. That's kind of paraphrasing what he said there, but yeah. So it definitely was one of those things that effort was put in there, and I think that's the thing with. I definitely agree with the dream anime thing. It's like, I couldn't imagine this movie being done in another format. The closest, probably, kind of dreamy kind of movie, but it's a very different thing, is like Inception. Mm-hmm.
Which people have compared to this film.
Right, and it came out after. It's one of those things where you could be like, oh, was it like influenced by this? And it's like, eh, I don't know. It's hard to say. It's possible.
It's the Battle Royale Hunger Games.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like, it could have been, it might not have been. No one, I think, is going crazy over it. But, I mean, people have been thinking about dreams and how to turn those into films since people have been making films.
True.
Well, I don't want to spoil the anime party, but apparently Amazon holds live-action rights to this.
Really?
I saw something like that. Yeah, it's going to be dumb. I mean, number one, they probably won't actually do it.
I sure hope not.
Because they spent all their money on making 8 seasons of the Lord of the Rings. That nobody cares about. But yeah, I definitely, this is one of those things where you're like, oh man, I couldn't imagine this movie being done in any other way. And certainly not. For, you know, like we said, roughly a $3 million budget.
Yeah, there's no way live action could be done less than this. And I mean, I think that's partially a, not necessarily a good indicator, because that's just a larger indicator of how, like, underpaid anime people are as a whole.
That's
that
true.
That goes back, obviously, further than this, but it's still the true now, right? Like, I mean, it's an unfortunate truth of this industry, is things are made on shoestring budgets for the kind of quality that people expect, and you're seeing, you know, nowadays you're seeing a lot more, I would say, visibility on that and more pushback. Like, you know, yeah, episodes being delayed, right? So that the staff don't like implode from the impossible schedules and stuff like that. But
you know, I've been thinking about this recently, kind of somewhat of an aside, where like these things, I remember hearing about the Jujutsu Kaisen and the animators leaking that they were getting paid like, I don't know, $10 a page or something like that. And I was like, dude, I would pay, I don't know, 5 times that maybe, or you know, 3 times that per page to have those pages, right? Like if they could do like some Kickstarter style thing where people would just,
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
You know, or like people could own those pages. I mean, I don't know, that's probably not a whole lot of people like me, but
Know. I feel like there's probably a fair number of people like you. I mean, cell, you know, technically speaking, cells were illegally being sold and were a big business for a while. Now it's all digital, so there's less of that. But
I'm just saying, if I was a billionaire, I would be funding anime films and shows.
I would angel if I was FU wealthy, I'd just angel invest cool sounding projects like this, because I want to see more cool stuff get made, and I want to see people with talent actually be compensated fairly for it.
So. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, for reals.
So completely aside, just because I had the note on it here, this movie, when it was released theatrically in the U.S., was apparently rated R.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
And I'm like, I guess, kind of, maybe. I mean, for what, like,
it could
four seconds of non-sexual nipple?
Yeah. And that weird unzipping of
Was
Eva. I feel like that one scene is probably what did it. I feel like without that scene, it probably would have gotten through with PG-13.
But it's one of those things where it just kind of feels like, yeah, that's unfortunate that it did that, because you know, generally that's why all of the everyone wants that PG-13 rating as opposed to R, because it just cuts out so much of your potential audience. I was surprised. I was like, and that's another thing I think is surprising for it getting a theatrical release, is that it was a R-rated animated movie, but it wasn't like what I think of like as an R-rated animated movie of like Ninja Scroll.
Yeah, which really earns it.
Or even Perfect Blue, right?
Like, yeah,
Perfect Blue is adequately rated as an rated
yes.
R. I'm assuming it's rated R. I get what you're saying. You know, I wonder what if maybe this came out at a time where things were getting, you know, more animated things are getting more harshly evaluated. Because, you know, 06 is now, I would say, in the midst of the anime boom of the aughts.
Yeah, I think that was before the crash, wasn't
when
it?
When it was imploding, I think, was around 07, but I think it was a little later in 07.
Mm. Yeah. So, well, this was released theatrically in the US in May of 07, but I feel like that's pretty independent of the implosion of the whole market.
Because
that's pretty unrelated there.
Yeah.
Mike, what are your thoughts on this movie? What's the things that stood out to you with it?
Sorry, I was distracted on a tangent. So Musicland, that had Sam Goody and started some of the implosion of the anime industry, filed for Chapter 11 in January of 06. So I guess that took a bit to while its way through things. I'm just remembering that at some point in 07 I was getting those insane Right Stuff Jenny on like 25 discs for $100 sales.
Oh man, the good old days.
Yeah. Well, so what did you think of the movie?
I liked it. I'm not sure if I understood it less than when I watched it the first time, or if I just liked it more, like, because I remember my feeling when I first saw it was not, like, thinking it was my least favorite of Coen's films just because, unlike all of the rest of them, it didn't feel like it added enough new to me if you had already seen his previous work.
Hmm.
Hmm.
And I think it's been long enough since, and, you know, I've mixed more other anime movies in that that's less of an impact, where before, you know, all of Coen's previous films were a pretty large subset of the anime movies I had seen.
I wonder, what if you were to try and show somebody the Satoshi Kon movie oeuvre or whatever, what order would you show it to them in?
All right, so we've
great
got,
question.
All right, so we've got Perfect Blue, Millennium Actress, Tokyo Godfathers, and Paprika.
As
feature
with
yep, movies.
Yep, for feature length films.
That's it, which is crazy. Gosh.
What do you think? I would think Tokyo Godfathers is kind of the, if I put that one first, they're kind of like, it's normal and it's very good. So, like, they'll stick around for sure.
It's his one feel-good movie, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's a Christmas movie. It's Home Alone. It's
yeah,
all of that, right? It's Satoshi Kon doing a Christmas movie, and that was great.
And anime Christmas movies are far enough between that that's a good in to start with it right by itself.
Yeah, I would agree. I think Tokyo Godfathers has got the broadest reach and the easiest pull for people that are casual to non-anime
mm-hmm.
watchers. And then...
Eh. No?
No?
I don't know. I don't know if I would go with that, because it's
okay.
Like... Well, it's kind of like... It's just one of those things where there's no right or answer. It also depends on, like, explicitly, like, who the person is and what is your goal. Like, if your goal is to make someone... Like, I want to make this person see that anime is not just, like, I don't know, One Piece or whatever. Or Pokemon. Yeah, anime is.
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
I might honestly go for, like, Paprika and be like, yeah, this movie is, like, a trip, but watch it. And you'll be like, what the heck? Like, I think if I saw it... Because, like, I remember, like, the first time that I saw anime, and it was nearly, or it might have been on the same night, we watched, like, the first episode or two of Bubblegum Crisis and Akira. And I saw those, and I was like, my mind was blown, and my mind is still blown. And I'm like, wow, that is so different. Like, because all I had seen before that for animated stuff was, like, Disney stuff. And fairly recently, it was, like, Little Mermaid, which I was like... this doesn't mean anything to me, like, but I see Akira and I'm like, oh yeah, now I'm hooked.
I see.
You got me.
So you get Paprika up front to kind of show the potential of it.
I might go with that. Yeah. Cause also it's not quite as like, and again, I haven't seen Perfect Blue in quite a long time, but that's also, I might almost go with that for like a different market a person where like, oh, you want to see a really cool animated, like creepy, like kind of horror suspense reality weird movie that way, like, yeah, then go for Perfect Blue. But I think I might honestly go with Paprika, because also, like, it just looks so freaking cool and pretty everywhere, and like, it is, I honestly still think it's one of the best produced mixed versions of 2D, 3D, like, animation.
It is pretty good.
And that, like you can see stuff in a few spots, but for the most part, they said there's, like, CG stuff in, like almost, like, half the cuts have CG in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't look like it most of the time.
It's definitely Madhouse at their best with CG, for sure.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I could buy that. I would say Perfect Blue. I would probably put that last. Even if there's somebody who might like it, like, that's a high risk. They might just not want to watch anymore after that.
I would say Perfect Blue, they would have to be, like, either a Hitchcock fan, or I know they like edgy kind of stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what it comes down to is the more if it's the less familiar I am with someone's taste, the more likely I'm going to start with the safest option, which is, in my opinion, Tokyo Godfathers. Mm-hmm. If it's somebody whose taste I at least have a beat on, I would lean towards agreeing more with Dylan. Although I think even then, Millennium Actress might still be a better fit, just because that Millennium Actress also is, I would say, more family friendly. Like, I remember showing it to my parents and not being like weirded out showing it.
Yeah, Millennium Actress is also a good one for someone who's a film buff who is into classic movies. Absolutely.
And it's also got that kind of dreamlike quality that you can't really get with other mediums.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, especially the way it's told, like, the way the story is told and, you know, cuts of her career, right?
Yeah, so, like, you could do it with CG now, but it probably wouldn't be worth the budget to do it as well as it would deserve.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then as much as I enjoy, I would agree, Perfect Blue probably would regardless be, unless it's somebody who's like, I know specifically is into effed up, you know, murder mystery thriller stuff, and I'd be like, oh, here you go. This is perfect for you. And to be fair, I am like that. That's why I think I enjoy Perfect Blue the most. But yeah, I think within his four feature length films, I think the beauty is that he actually kind of has something to offer for anybody.
He really does.
Within his very short, you know, discography, like, you know, only four feature length films, but I think he pretty much covers a pretty wide gamut of watchability for a vast amount of audiences, I feel like.
Yeah, I feel like the only real miss from him would be someone who is, shall we say, so uptight that they can't identify with the protagonists of Tokyo Godfathers at all.
They're a lost cause.
Yeah.
Fine. You don't deserve these movies. Yeah, really? Is Tokyo Godfathers G?
It's PG at worst, I would say, because there's, like, alcohol use in it.
Oh, yeah.
Probably. True. But I haven't watched it in a while, but I don't recall there being... I remember thinking, like, oh, this is what happens when Satoshi Kon tries to make a family movie. Cool. And it was cool. It's, again, still one of my favorite Christmas movies. Like, I would have little problem showing this to any of my extended family, even. And they're like, "Why? What's this animated stuff?" So, like,
PG-13, and I believe that has to do with what I said about uptight people and this having been released in 2003.
Yeah. Mm. Even Ghibli stuff oftentimes doesn't get G ratings.
Oh, yes. So IMDb says PG-13 for thematic events, violent images, language, and some sexual material. So, yeah.
Oh, because of a specific character. Yeah, I can see that being.
Been so long since I've seen it. So.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see here. We're coming up on the end time here. The thing that I think I wanted to highlight, and it came through in watching all of the extras and listening to all that stuff, which is pretty cool. It's nice. None of them are crazy long and you can stop them, but is just how much in Paprika and all of Khan's stuff, but I think in Paprika, just because I watched it and it's there, like how much thought and detail went into every single thing that you see and you hear and you do and you don't, like,
mm-hmm.
every single thing, like the animation director, he's talking like, oh yeah, so this scene where you're driving the car into the rain, oh man, I put so much work into putting a CG thing on the ground below to give a nice little reflective tone in there to make it look just right. And like, wow. The opening segment is like so cool. It is so well done. It reminded me a little bit of the first part of it reminded me of some of the frames of the Ken Ishii music video, because she's kind of coming at you wearing the goggles and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then the dream, like, parade, right? Like, that's a literal visual feast. I mean,
and that's pretty much everything that's in there is all like hand drawn stuff.
Exactly. To be fair, they do reuse pretty much like the same, you know, whatever, five cuts, but those five cuts probably took a titanic amount of time to make, because if you look pause in any second of that, and you can see hundreds of individually drawn things from, you know, of various things, be it dolls, frogs, anthropomorphized stuff. Like, it was, like I said, it's a visual feast of a scene. So I get why they reused it, but
yeah,
completely agree. You can just see this is really Madhouse putting everything they have into something, in my opinion. I'm hard pressed to think about something that is more visually striking than this by them.
The visual from this that I still can't unsee is just the characters essentially like leaping into a TV like they're, you know, the Duke brothers, and then coming out the camera.
Yeah, that was so great.
That was so cool.
All of those are just so, oh man, yeah, so creative. Really, just anime is so perfect for that. And it was, yeah, Khan executed that and his team just so well.
Yeah, the film just feels very intentional. You can tell how much thought was put into everything. Even if you can't understand it, you can tell they thought about it.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll take a roundabout. Folks can either say if they have like a favorite scene, segment, song, line, something. We'll keep it positive here, and we'll go in intro order. So we'll go with Nick first. Final thoughts on Paprika.
I would say my favorite, like, one I love it, as flawed as it is with the ending, I still really, I'm glad that we opted to do this episode. Again, just visually such a fantastic movie, and, you know, I don't think Cohen has left anything on the table as far as, like, you know, execution wise, in my opinion. As far as favorite scene, honestly, I have a soft spot for the detective, and that whole segment when he's finally pieced together and, like, remembers everything, like, oh man, this terrible movie that me and my best friend made, and you're seeing, you know, like, kind of the way that, like, really broke and poor and kind of crappy, like, amateur filmmakers, you know, the tricks they have to use, like, they use, like, you know, an undokai as, like, a set piece for that one, you know, for one cut and stuff like that, and I something about that was so cool, and, like, the way they animated it, again, was so thoughtful. So, yeah, that's probably my favorite scene in the movie.
Okay.
I don't know if I have a favorite scene. I mean, I definitely loved the into the TV, out of the camera. That was just so smart. A lot of those transitions were really good, but that was definitely really good. But yeah, I also like Nick. I like the detective, Konakawa. He was really, he's almost like the straight man, I guess, which was fun to see. And he had the kind of almost, his weird relationship with Paprika, how he's like getting services from her, and it's almost portrayed as like a sexual thing, but it's not. It's just this weird psychological thing. It's so funny. And then I guess later in the movie they reveal that the professor is his contact to getting the secret service. Yes. All his stuff was just so good. I really loved his story, and the thing that I remember for the first time that I saw the movie was the bartenders jumping off the building. that was so great. Or they, like, come to save the day. Yeah, that's it for me.
All right, Mike, what you got?
Yeah, well, I already used my camera scene. I'd say the other one that's kind of striking is just the line of people diving off the top of a building like synchronized swimmers.
Oh, yeah. Man, that is, and you so know those guys incredibly animated.
Those guys have to be like real life staffers or friends, right?
I was thinking
they gotta be. They have to be. Like, they were drawn so precisely. Like, they have to be. Somebody's got to do some digging in a rabbit hole for that one.
Yeah, definitely. All right. I'm going to go with, I really love the segment where Paprika is in the fairy mode and then goes flying out of the shell of Himura. I think it's really coolly done. Like, it's a great mix of, I think they had a term for it, they called it, like, it wasn't hybrid, it was something else they called it, but this mix of 2D, 3D stuff there, it looks really good, and the music's cool. It was just, I thought it was just, it's one of those kind of, like, it's not the crazy scene as much as the parade or the weather girl going crazy and dancing off in the background and everything, but it was just, I thought it was a cool scene.
Executed well, because I didn't actually even, it never even occurred to me that there was any CG in that part, so good job.
Yeah.
I will say one last little thing, and obviously it was heavy-handed, but I appreciated it when the very last scene where the detective Konokawa, you know, is saying, more or less saying bye to Paprika, and she left, and I was like, oh, by the way, you should watch this movie. I hear it's pretty good. And he's walking in, and you look at the marquee, and it's showing, you know, marquees for, like,
oh, Perfect yeah.
Blue, like his point of film. I'm like,
yeah.
Even he had to flex there. He's like, by the way, guys, I have made other stuff too.
Well, I think in the commentary he says, yeah, I also just kind of did that because, like, I knew we didn't have to get rights for anything.
Oh.
Clever.
Nice.
Cullen, aside from his storyboards being insane, like, there's so many, like, the commentary is hilarious. There's so many of these little random things in the movie where he's like, oh, yeah, I animated that. Yeah, I drew that. Like, he was just like, yeah, I probably shouldn't have done this, but, like, I didn't want to put it off on someone else, like, to draw this ice cube and, like, make it look exactly the way I wanted it, because that would just feel mean, so I went and did it. And he's like, so the entire commentary is hilarious, like, every minute he's like, yeah, I did that. It's like, I did way too much.
I can absolutely see it, like, I can only imagine Cone's storyboards must be incredible, because he feels like someone who both had that drive and detail that he couldn't let it go, and the ability to actually draw it.
Yeah, three
yeah,
years.
They show the storyboards in some of the extras. They are, I've looked at a good number of ones. They are the most incredible storyboards I've ever seen.
Like, I've seen manga pages worse than those. Like,
oh yeah, way worse. Like, good looking manga pages that look worse.
He was like, in some of the stuff in the making of, he was I'm pretty sure he was like tracing over versions to like do cleaner versions of his storyboards. Like,
I think so too. His storyboards are insane. Like, you're just like, oh my god, this is so crazy.
The other thing I recall about watching any making of stuff with Kun was, like, you see the ashtray just piling on with cigarettes.
Oh gosh,
like, literally hundreds of cigarette butts just piled in front of him. I'm like, oh, dude, that's not good for you.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, he needed something to keep him, to burn the midnight oil with, so I get it, but...
Yeah. All right, well, with that, we are going to wrap up here. Next time, we're going to do an episode covering a new, shorter hour-long movie called Look Back. It had a theatrical run. Sam saw it, said it was excellent, recommended, so we're gonna watch that. It is available now, streaming on Amazon, so... if you have that and you want to catch up, give a check out on Look Back. And then, as a reminder as well, going into the Wayback Machine is, you can find it on YouTube, but the Studio 4C has put up an official, upscaled version of Noiseman Sound Insect. So if you want to see another crazy old weird experimental animation thing, that's there too, and we'll probably discuss that as part of something at some point too.
Yeah, only 15 minutes, right? So
yeah,
easy to squeeze in when you have a break.
So with that, I say thanks for listening. And until next time, this is AMO Kenzoku saying Saraba.